Five, four, three, two, one. I'm John Miglosh for the WDMA and the NMOA. And I've cut loose from the tyranny of running this every day at 10 o'clock in the morning. Yes, my impressions are down, but what's an impression anyway? So I've just given up on the whole baloney. And hopefully they'll be better. I hope so. I'm going to work on that. So let's start out with Tom Fishburne. AI co-pilots and the future of work. Don't worry, I'm only here to be your co-pilot. Whew, that's the most productive way to work together. Or what's the most productive way to work together? You can start by dusting my monitor and emptying the wastebasket. That's a good one. That's one of his better ones. Okay, so Tom writes, I like the analogy of AI as co-pilot. Microsoft's been branding their tools as co-pilot, but the co and co-pilot, you know, if your pilot just had a heart attack, the co-pilot takes over, right? Yeah, and for some reason, I don't know why, maybe YouTube keeps track of my preferences, but I occasionally watch airplane tragedies and how they happened. And there was a recent one of a YouTube influencer who didn't understand how to run her autopilot and plowed right into the ground. And basically the thing just kept going up and down like this, bigger and bigger and bigger until it ran right into the ground. And apparently she didn't understand what was going on and didn't know how to disengage the co-pilot, the autopilot. Sad. I can't imagine that that's possible, but apparently it was. It was a much, you know, she'd done so well on Instagram or something that she could buy a much fancier plane with much more power. And she apparently didn't know how to read the instruments and see what was going on. So, will AI tools serve more as enablers or replacers? Or plow you right into the ground? MIT recently conducted the first controlled experiment into productivity, and they found that GitHub coders completed their work 55% faster with AI. Was it better? Don't know. That's the question. So, who will reap the benefits of that 55%? The IMF predicted a few months ago that 60% of jobs in advanced economies will be impacted by AI. I was a little disappointed with the article. Usually the article is way better than the cartoon, but in this case, I think the cartoon was better. And Tom just mentions a couple of these things. Brian Westover at PC Magazine said, in the long run, the centaur wins, which is a combination of the human and the animal. And at that point, you need to decide whether you'll be the human at the front or the one looking at the horse's rear end. I'm not sure the metaphor works. I was a little disappointed But how can you predict this stuff? No one else can predict it. Why should we expect Tom to predict it? Have you figured out how AI will impact our business? Working on it, how will it impact our business? There are many ways that AI can impact, right? I used AI this morning. AI written, AI read. AI turns this single bullet point into a long email I can pretend I wrote. AI makes a single bullet point out of this long email I can pretend I read. I read that. I found out that I could, with WhatsApp, I can get hold of Meta and Meta's AI, and I asked it about why doctors are retiring early, and it gave me a whole list of stuff. I don't think I even read it. It seemed good at the time. How did you get budget approval for all this? I just told them the name of the project, AI. There you go. And that's all for today on Tom Fishburne. I also ran across this this post by Dr. Grace Kite. Measuring something changes the outcomes. And I also noted, and changing the outcome changes the measure also. So when I was very, very early into direct marketing and the measurement of that, I found out that the lifetime value was an important metric. And I started asking owners of companies, if your average customer after 5 years has returned $100 worth of profit to you, most people didn't really measure it that carefully, but let's just say, then what portion of that $100 are you willing to spend to acquire a customer? And the numbers varied, 25%, 30%, 50%, something like that. And the truth is that none of them trusted it. Why? Well, partly because even though you're measuring it quite carefully, let's suppose that they were, which I don't think that they were. I used to come in and do that analysis and find vastly different answers. But the problem is that the measurement over time changes and the outcome over time changes. So a good lifetime value was like a 4 or 5 year track record. You know, what were these customers that we acquired 5 years worth? But at the same time, what stayed the same after 5 years? Was the economic climate the same? Was the competitive climate the same? Was the acquisition method the same? No, none of it was the same. So why would you think that someone acquired today was going to be the same value as what you'd measured over the past 5 years? Another mentor told me that his two-time buyers were worth 4 times more money than the one-time buyers, most of which never came back. So he said, anything we can do to get a customer to buy a second time means they'll be worth 4 times more. I said, but when you originally measured it, had you been doing big incentives to get them to buy again? He said, no. I was just looking at the ones that had bought again versus the ones that didn't. I said, right. But now you're putting in incentives. You're saying, oh, 25% off your second order. That changes the game. Now when you measure, you have the expectation that they're going to be worth 4 times more because they've bought a second time. But in the previous measurement, they hadn't been incentivized, right? People do this with price manipulation, you know, with offers. They say, well, if we give a 10% discount, then our response goes up 40% or something. Right. But over time, that wears out. You're teaching your customers how to game the system. You know, I remember it was a menswear catalog, and I used to buy from it, and I would get the catalog, and I would look through the catalog, and I would decide the kinds of things that I wanted to buy, and then I'd wait for an email that gave me 25% off. Lands' End has been going to 40%, 50%. My goodness. So I never buy when it isn't that. You know, Kohl's runs that kind of game all the time. So not only does measurement change the outcome, but the outcome manipulation also changes the measurement. If you change your bathroom scale every day, will you know if you gained weight? Sometimes it's better to be consistent in your measurement rather than worrying about your precision. And I talk on these things all the time. It's a lot of fun. Okay, so 4 hours is the milestone time to beat for many runners. And so we see that 3 hours and 58 minutes or 59 minutes are the most common times. Okay, after that, everything tapers off. Measurement changes behavior in marketing too. Pre-testing doesn't always predict ad performance because people know they are being watched in the test. But not in the real world. People don't say what they do. Surveys have a similar problem. Likes, somebody, just because somebody says they like something doesn't mean they'll buy it. And here's that marathon times. See, they go up. Zoop. Before the 3-hour milestone. And they go up a lot at 3.5 hours. So if you can make it to that, and they go up also at 4 hours. And then they taper off dramatically. Right? So people beat themselves up to make these milestones. And down in the comments, there was a marathon runner, and he said, yep, everybody wanted to know how you did. Did you beat 4 hours? Which is a milestone, right? Right? So there's some great comments in here. What I like about LinkedIn posts is you get an interaction from the rest of the marketing world, right? It speaks about the importance of measuring things right, measuring the right things. Yeah, because it will manipulate things. There's also pacing runners who have big signs up saying 3 hours. If you want to match 3 hours, then you got to keep up with that guy. If you want to match 4 hours, you got to keep up with someone else. Okay, and so on. So naturally, there'll be a bunching of a bigger group right behind that runner. Right? That's putting the runner in. Make this more or less common where you get 358 or 359. Right there, look at that, it says that. Cool, I didn't learn any of this. But Bob Moore, one of the better comments, I thought, says that Dr. Grace Kite's point is that if no one had a watch or clocks on the route or pacing runners to know if they're on pace, then the bunching would disappear and you'd probably have a normal distribution here. You'd have a few runners that were really, really good way down here, and you'd have a few runners that barely made it across the finish line, and you'd have something much more like a normal distribution. That's what you should have, right? Also note, this was male finishers. Are males more goal-oriented? It would be nice to know that. Someone put that in the comments. I wonder if the female finishers, you know, I remember when it was thought that women shouldn't or couldn't run a marathon. Now they do like crazy, which shows you what expectation can do to you. Somebody, the first woman in the Boston Marathon had to sneak in. Well, we got lots of calls coming in. If you're running well, the first and last miles are the same speed. So if you've really got yourself, your pace down, you know, and you've planned for exactly that time threshold. Not sure my running days are over. And it's called Goodhart's Law that says in hospital waiting rooms, there's a sudden spike pushing people through just under 4 hours because that's a target, okay, in hospital waiting rooms. So when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. Fascinating stuff. Okay. More. Here's the best one, and then we'll go on to the next article. Martin Lawson writes, I remember seeing that mortality rates were especially low in the months leading up to the millennium, and then high in the months immediately afterwards. Okay, that was probably because of Y2K, which we were all warned about, how all of our computers and everything would shut down after, and you know, your kidney dialysis machines would quit and stuff. It didn't happen, gee whiz. But anyway, and Dr. Grace wrote, I did not see this one coming. Who would have thought you can hold back death, right? It was all those systems failing, but it wasn't. Yes, I believe you can hold back death. I believe a lot of people, you know, try to make it to a milestone in life, like a grandchild being born. My good friend, pediatrician, delivered the baby and died the next day. I think it was. It's either the same day or the next day. He wanted to make it. He wanted to deliver that baby. Fantastic, right? And once he did that, then he could go. Peace. So it's fantastic what actually happens This was another good one. Divorce rates peak at 39, 49, and 59. And as people reevaluate their lives before milestone birthdays. And it's also a reminder to question arbitrary targets from clients. And Dr. Grace agreed we should probably target people at 29, 39, 49 for marketing of all kinds of big life-changing purchases, divorce lawyers, lawyers notwithstanding. And there's actually an article called Targeting Nine Enders, Why Age is More Than Just a Number, which here's the link. So that'll be available in the show notes at WDMA.org. If you're a subscriber, you can go into the members-only area. It's free. And somebody suggested that maybe if we made the marathon 27 miles, we could see if that held up. And somebody else pointed out that in the Manchester Marathon in 2016, they shortened the course by 380 meters, and it would be interesting to see if that helped or hurt. Okay. So anyway, measurement is a dangerous and difficult thing. And we tend to think that measurement is the same as testing. And so I put up this survey. How do you define testing? Bob Stone agreed with me. I used to have coffee on the way home from Chicago. I'd stop off at Bob's house in Skokie, and we'd have coffee. I'd just drop in on him. It was fun. He seemed to like it. And I said, Bob, you know, your definition of direct marketing is measurement, is generating a measurable result. And I said, you know, first of all, measurable means you could measure, but you don't. Or if you're measuring, does that mean you're testing? And he said, John, you're so right. We were just too close to it. We couldn't imagine that someone would be able to measure and not test, right? It was just inconceivable because we worked so hard to measure, you know, to make a measurable result. Anyway, so here's 23 votes is one of my higher participation surveys, and 52%, just barely more than half, said measuring is testing is measuring the differential to a control. And those are the people that really, really know what they're talking about. If you just change something, do something differently, let's do this and then let's do that. No, time is not taken into account here. Trying new media options. A lot of people say, let's try direct mail. That is not testing. Different headlines and creative. You know, let's... Well, unless you do a careful A-B split, most of the time that's a convenience sample and you have no idea what's going on, right? So testing is important in two respects and different than just trying something. One respect is who's the population? How do we select that? You know, in classic direct mail, we do an A-B split. Every other mailer got A or B, okay? And so we get a homogeneous split. It's not as simple as that. You know, we used to do A-B splits within segments, so we were sure to get as many high-quality names, you know, in our RFM or in our modeling segments. We would segment it first, and then we would do the A-B split. Because if you just do A-B splits, you may have one side get many more of the good names and they can skew it dramatically. Okay, so one is, what's the population? Is it statistically significant? You know, are we just mailing 100 and saying, oh, now, you know, it's like flipping a coin. In the Ed Burnett seminar I took as a young direct mail guy, I was able to flip the coin 5 times. I don't even carry coins anymore. 5 times in a row and get heads. I was the only one in a room of at least 100, probably at least 200, that was able to do that. Of course, I practiced that in college while not studying for exams. But, you know, it worked itself out at 10. I was not able to get 10 heads in a row. You get nervous after a while. Somebody, Mark Davis, chimed in. Testing is establishing a starting point, your control. and then saying, I wonder how results would be improved if. That's the hypothesis. I wonder if. And then establishing measurements of success. That's execution of the experimental design, right? Not always raw response, sometimes cost to acquire, other metrics. Trying, modifying content, modifying contact strategy, integrating channels, then measuring the results of all of the above. I would take issue with that, Mark. You don't want to measure all of the above. You really want to measure one thing or everything, and it's really an art more than a science. Mark says Bob Stone was his hero. Sarah Fletcher chimed in, says it's interesting. Now that we have amazing access to great data, people aren't testing. I agree. Why guess when you can know? And I said, because guessing is much easier and more fun. And if you actually test, you may be dramatically shown wrong. No one wants to be shown wrong. Then she replied, I think there's also a myth that as crack marketers, we should already know the right answer. The real art of testing is knowing what to test and interpret the results in an actual way. Amen, Sarah. And I replied, right, one large cataloger was told by his CFO, testing reduces corporate profits because one side wins and one side loses. Shouldn't we just mail 100% of the winner? Yes, but how do we know unless we set up a test? And that's a real CFO in one of the biggest catalogs in America. Okay, enough for now. Have a great day. Like and share. Your friends will know you're smart. Thanks for participating.